Hey there, you're listening to Filmed in Canada.
It's a podcast about Canadian movies.
If you enjoy what you hear, go to the iTunes store and leave a review for us. It really helps us get noticed.
And if you'd like to continue the discussion, you can check out our Facebook page. Just search Filmed in Canada Podcast. And you can also reach us by email at filmedincanada@gmail.com.
And feel free to go to our website, filmedincanada.net, for our other content and to leave a comment.
Hey, Chris.
Hi, Alexander.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good, thanks. We are here to talk about the Vancouver International Film Festival.
It's that time of year again.
Yes, it is roughly around the end of September into the second to third week of October right now. That's generally when they start the festival.
And like the PNE, it almost always rains during the VIF.
Yes. Although I guess I would say there's probably more rain than during PNE time.
I would say so.
Yeah.
Which means you have to queue up in the rain for a lot of films.
Mm-hmm. So we're doing something a bit different this year. We are more prepared than in previous years in terms of our festival coverage, as we have gotten access to screeners prior to the festival starting, as opposed to during the festival. And we can bring you listeners out there some previews of a few movies that we've been able to watch and give you an idea of what to look out for on the CanCon side, and I guess offer more insight than usual so that you can decide if you're more likely to see something. As I'm rambling a bit here, but what I don't like about going to a film festival is you see the program and every movie's the best. Every movie's amazing. Every movie is iconic and epic and whatever the fuck, and I hate it because you end up, you go into these things and you're just like, wait, this is not good.
How do you feel that you did last year?
I think
you saw maybe, 13 to 18 films.
Yeah.
Do you feel like 15 were amazing? Do you feel like 10 were amazing? What were your... number shake out?
I can't even really remember that well, but probably like less than 5 were amazing.
I feel like I did 13 for 13.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I have an acute eye or anything, but whatever I chose, it knocked me out.
Cool.
Yeah. So it seems unlikely that I could do it again this year, but I have 17 films chosen, and it would be amazing if...
Although, well, last
13
year...
13 of those were fantastic.
Last year was the Guy Madden...
yes.
Fuck, I forget what it was called.
The Hitchcock.
Yeah, but like the recreation of Vertigo by way of just other movies that were made in San Francisco. And it was just the best. It was so good.
I think there are singular experiences that you have the joy of being a part of when you go to the VIF. So while it's amazing to have screeners that you can watch in your own home, there is something about participating in these singular, unique events that you can't capture when you're on your couch.
Yeah. That being said, we did watch the two movies that we're going to discuss today on our couches, or at least I was on my couch.
I was on my couch as well. Yeah.
You were at the treadmill.
Different couches.
Yeah. So we're going to start off with Edge of the Knife. And then William's going to join us in a bit to talk about This Mountain Life. Nice rhyming scheme there. I do not have a limerick prepared. But... yeah, let's just jump into it. So Edge of the Knife, I don't have any notes. It looks like you have some notes, so maybe you could provide us with some insights around who made it and what it's about.
I ran out of time to do a little extra homework, so you have to bear with me as well. I can give you a plot synopsis. It takes place in the summer in the 19th century, so pre-colonial contact. Two families get together.
Pre-colonial contact in Haida Gwaii.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's what I read on the Wikipedia page.
That's crazy.
During production. So
yeah.
I think because it's so remote,
yeah.
it may not have had contact as early as the coast here.
Yeah.
So I was surprised to read that as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't, it's hard to get a sense of what time it is when you're watching the film.
Yeah.
I knew it was old timey, but I wasn't sure exactly where it was centered in the timeline.
Right.
So annually, these two families come together on an island in Haida Gwaii for a fishing retreat.
Yeah.
Where they do a bunch of catching, drying.
Prepare for the winter.
To prepare for the winter. So there's two different clans. And then once it's time to go, then they retreat to their separate islands to not meet again until the following summer for the fishing retreat.
Yeah.
And there is it centers the story centers on a young Haida man who has some swagger, and he accidentally kills his best friend's son in a fishing accident.
Right.
And as he grieves, he retreats into the woods and becomes the wild man, which is a story in Haida storytelling.
Right.
And we don't see him again until the following summer when the families come back. And they assume that he has also perished in the fishing accident. And they didn't know that he had been living as the wild man in the intervening months.
Right. Yeah, okay. That clarifies a lot for me, actually, because okay. I didn't know why or how the kid had died.
I think the father, Kwa, said, "You're not going to get black cod this season."
Yeah.
The weather doesn't look good. And then his
best friend doesn't listen
and takes the kid out anyways.
Yeah, because there's a conversation between this father and the son where he is describing the clouds and how, like, as you get older, you'll be able to understand the weather patterns and stuff like that. And yeah, I guess he does warn them that the weather's not going to be good and is quite angry when he finds that the son has been taken out. And I guess the mother tries to console him and say, you know, oh, they'll be fine kind of thing. Aditi knows what he's doing. Okay, yeah, that makes a lot more sense. Because I guess without spoiling anything, there were some other kind of familial revelations later on in the movie that I felt like it might have been related to that, just because I wasn't really cluing into what the cause was. I didn't understand that it was just an accident. I figured it might have actually been born out of rage or something like that.
Okay. I mean, it isn't explicitly explained.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Part of that could have been the couchside experience of watching the movie, because in that first 20 minutes, we were kind of finishing our dinner and getting up and down a few times and getting distracted by a few things. But, when movies started using drone photography over the past few years, there was another documentary about Haida Gwaii that we watched, which I think was called The Edge of the World or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
And there was this drone shot in it that I really hated, and it was just kind of gratuitous, and I can't really remember, and like hate's obviously a strong word, and I probably don't hate it, but I didn't like this drone shot, and for like a whole lot of years, I just found that people weren't using them in the right way, or just didn't feel fluid the way that a Steadicam does, or something like that. But in this movie, there's some overhead shots of the scenery, and just kind of that like as compared to a helicopter shot that feels kind of more dynamic, and like, you know, the camera's moving in conjunction with the motion of the helicopter, and so there's typically more motion in a helicopter shot. They're kind of more fluid, whereas it feels like a lot of the drone photography, the camera can be very static, and it's just the drone that's moving, and it just kind of creates this hypnotic feel that I
agree
that you don't really get from like another type of aerial shot, I guess. And so I do feel like over the past few years, that technique has been refined. And in this movie in particular, I feel like the way that the landscape is captured is really stunning.
I absolutely noticed that drone shot as well. There's especially one where you're seeing the sort of the tall tops of the cedars and the mist running through the tops of the cedars.
Yeah.
And like 10 years ago, how would you catch? You can't barge up a crane to Haida Gwaii to get that shot 10 years ago.
No, I know.
I think you just wouldn't have that shot.
Yeah.
And I think that it would be prohibitively expensive to get a chopper for a film that was shot for like $1.8 million.
Yeah, exactly.
And most of the pre-production and production was put into having the language learned by the actors, having translators. So you're not going to spend $50,000 on a helicopter. So I thought the drone work was beautiful.
This isn't Freddy Got Fingered we're talking about here.
That's right.
Where he literally gets $1 million to make an animated show and spends however many hundreds of thousands of dollars on that just to get a helicopter so that he can impress his girlfriend and talk about how he wants her to suck his cock.
Classy.
What a gem of a movie that is.
Brought to you by Telefilm Canada.
No kidding, eh?
No, I don't know.
I'm pretty sure it was an American production company.
Oh.
But it was made in Canada. But God, that movie is a wild ride.
I have not seen it.
Oh wow. It's something. but not just the drone photography, but actually when he's kind of like becoming this wild man and running through the forest.
Yes.
There was, I don't know if it was a Steadicam or if that was also a drone that was following him, but that did really feel like a Steadicam. I just couldn't see someone successfully running through the forest and operating a camera because you're going through this unlevel ground. And even for the actor to be doing that barefoot. And
that is some Andy Serkis type extraordinary movement work.
Yeah.
That actor who's not a professional actor.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you do that during the production? I mean, it was incredible.
Yeah.
He was so dynamic. And again, he's barefoot, shirtless, and running through, a rainforest.
Mm-hmm.
I actually made a note of that too, and I called it a Raimi cam from...
Yeah, totally.
Looked like Sam Raimi, and which I think they would just put the camera on 2 2x4s and then get four
someone
of the production
to run with it.
Crew
just
to run really fast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that, obviously that's... I'm sure they did something a lot more sophisticated, but it was
effective. It did have a lot more vertical motion to it than those Raimi shots did. But yeah, it totally made me think of Evil Dead.
Yeah.
And then also there's whether it's a dolly or whatever, when he's, I think it's the opening shot of the movie when he's running through the forest and it's just this lateral shot following along with him. I couldn't tell if that was like CG'd or, cause again, it like, they must have just been right on the edge of the forest or like, I don't think they would have been clear-cutting an area so that they could have a clear area for the camera to move.
Right.
So, how did they capture that? And again, he's just barreling through these trees, and there's scratches on him, and you would think a lot of that is prosthetics, but I would imagine that he probably did get
I'm sure he
scratched
was absolutely
up
abused during that production. I mean, I'm sure it was a labor of love, but there's no way that actor did not get pretty beaten up.
Yeah.
That scene where he pushes his way through the thorn bush.
No, I know.
Oh, it was just absolutely brutal to watch.
Yeah. Or when he takes that anemone or whatever it is and stings his face and that was one thing that I was also confused about was in terms of when he goes through this transformation, because they have that I don't have the right words to describe it, but I guess ritual where the families are around the fire and the two men run in with the masks on and they're kind of scaring the kids and whatever. And I guess it's some form of storytelling, but there's no words. And so we don't really know what the story is. Presumably it is related to this wild man because the mask that he's wearing has those...
Are they porcupine quills or...?
Yeah, they have those quills that he ends up having on his face. So there seems to be some sort of visual rhyming going on there. But I was thinking, okay, maybe he went through this transformation as a part of this ritual and then he goes and kills the kid. Like that's where there was this confusion in my mind,
right?
Because you don't see them go out on the fishing boat, you don't see what happens to the kid, but I guess since he's on the shore, he must have just washed up or whatever. Because when they're running out as well, I thought it was because they saw the boat.
When the husband is following the wife?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know what sort of emotional call she was getting that she knew to crest that hill and then see.
But I thought when they were at the main where they have the longhouse, when she's looking out, I thought I could actually see the canoe on the water.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't notice that.
But then the kid just shows up washed up. And anyway, we don't need to belabor that point in terms of when he goes through the transformation or how it happens or whatever. But I was watching with my girlfriend and she made the point that when he's first running through the forest, at that point he just seems scared and he's not really, he hasn't really maybe made gone through the transformation yet. Like it's not until he starts to see the fake fires and stuff like that. And
I think the transformation happens when the Raimi cam goes into the tree and then and then when he wakes up, then he has become the wild man. So I think it's that exact moment of the transformation. I think he's grieving and that's the mania.
Yeah.
But then once we push into his sort of den under the tree, I think that's where he becomes the wild man.
Right. Yeah, no, that definitely makes a lot more sense. And I get it's interesting that it is a representation of this kind of ancient story, but it's also I wonder if some of the other plot elements of the movie are a part of that story as well, like if it does involve an accidental death or the familial the grieving and the anger and the splitting of sides that goes on, if that is also part of the story, because it's interesting how, if it's not, that they've kind of put it in the context of these two families and the effect of that death has on them, and how the father just wants nothing more than to beat the life out of his cousin that has killed his son.
Right.
But obviously, again, without spoiling anything, there's some other facets to that anger, I think. I find it interesting in the way that, a good kind of supernatural horror movie is able to represent cultural fears that we have in the same way, him turning into this wild man is a really interesting way of exploring the grieving process and, the detachment that might occur if you were sort of outcast from your family as a result of this terrible tragedy. And how people decide to deal with that. What's also interesting is how this group of people reacts to that situation, and how I feel like that would be different from, if this same kind of plot line were made by Sam Raimi or something like that.
Right.
Like the revenge aspects or the maybe not revenge, but the desire to punish this man who has brought on this tragedy. I feel like that might be played up more, whereas that only really happens for a short while, and then it becomes about his healing and his bringing him back into the family, and you know, not trying to destroy him, and understanding that, you know, like he deserves to live just as much as any of them.
And he deserves to be exercised, mm-hmm. the wild man. I thought it was so, the word's not cavalier, but they were sort of casual about, he has become the wild man. We have to capture him in order to sort of exercise the wild man out of him. That's our obligation as a family.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just like, oh, I guess he's just going to wander around as a wild man. Maybe we'll see him annually. It was like, no, it's our obligation to free him from
even
possession.
Even if it causes them more pain to do
that's
that, because they have to end up inflicting some wounds on him as part of that healing process.
Right.
And it doesn't seem like that's easily accomplished, but they go through it because they know that going through that healing and coming out the other side is a better alternative.
Right. When the mother finds Gaz, the son, drowned at the beach, and then they bring the body back to the circle of women, and the women start keening.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, I was just bawling. It was so painful. And that keening was just so, just got under my skin. It was just so raw and genuine.
Mm-hmm.
What a way to grieve.
No, I know.
And then she cuts off her hair and throws it in the fire. It's
yeah.
like, oh my God. When I just think of how buttoned up and repressed we are when it comes to death and grieving, and how we do it so silently and hoping that no one will notice that we're sad.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just such a demonstration of grief that is just, it's as vital as life.
Mm-hmm.
And it really moved me. I thought that was a really profound scene.
Yeah. So I'm thinking we want to keep these two discussions fairly brief, just so that we're not overwhelming anyone. And we also are just trying to give a preview for people to hopefully go and check this out while it's at the festival, because knowing how Canadian movie releases go, this might be your one and only chance, or one of a very select few chances. So, I mean, I would resoundingly recommend that people go and see this for sure. I don't. I'm assuming you're on the same page.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I like not to kind of toot our horn or anything as Canadians, but it just seems like a very unique thing to be able to come out of you know, a cultural industry to experience, you know, this ancient story, and in a very remote area of the world that has such a beautiful landscape, and with spoken of a language that apparently only has 20 fluent speakers, which is at the beginning. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like, isn't that just unbelievable that
I assume,
it's an endangered language
yeah.
with 20 active speakers when this film went into production.
Yeah.
But how enriching that all of the cast and crew get to absorb this, you know what I mean? This language revitalization, which is just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
What a gift to everybody, to us, so that we get to hear two different dialects of Haida, and for all the cast and crew that got to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's incredible.
Totally. So we will be back shortly with William in tow to discuss the documentary This Mountain Life. And we are back. Unfortunately, without William, as he is stuck in traffic, but we are going to soldier on without him and get into a second discussion about a documentary that is new to the scene making its premiere at VIFF and later presumably on the Knowledge Network, which we are, I guess, now fans of, given that we've talked about a few things that have been on there.
Yeah, Shut Up and Say Something from last year made it there, yeah. As did Our People Will Be Healed,
yeah.
The Cree documentary that I watched.
And then we talked about that that one about the mine up in northern BC that I'm blanking on the name of now.
Conaline?
No. Yeah.
Conaline?
Yeah, that's right.
Is
yeah.
that how
yeah.
you pronounce it?
I don't know.
Okay.
But yeah, that one was on Knowledge Network as well. So it seems like they are doing good by the peoples of British Columbia and other parts of Canada to get some quality documentaries out there. So I'm blanking on the director's name.
Grant Baldwin.
Right. So he is the director, editor, writer, songwriter.
What a show off.
Wearing all hats in this production, it seemed, looking at the credits. But just sort of a movie about mountains, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw Grant's first documentary, and he and I'm sorry if I don't have her name in front of me, but his partner Jennifer, who is also producing This Mountain Life,
yeah,
they did a movie called The Clean Bin Project.
Right.
And they had a screening at the Vancouver Public Library and then had a little Q&A after the screening. So that was the first time I got to see,
like, I remember seeing signs of that.
Grant
yeah.
Baldwin. It
yeah.
was fantastic.
Yeah.
But I didn't see his second feature, which was, I think, Waste, a Love Story, or Waste, something about a documentary about food waste.
Okay.
So this is radically different.
Yeah.
And so impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, wow, what a good-looking documentary. Mm-hmm. Just incredible.
Yeah. And yeah, I guess my generic introduction at the beginning of just being it being a movie about mountains is because it doesn't really take a particular focus, which is interesting because we just made mention of that Conaline one, and watching that one, I found I was kind of torn between it not being specific enough about one plot line, mm-hmm. or not being general enough. Like it was kind of in this weird middle ground where it was following all these different strands, but I didn't really feel them connecting in the same way. Whereas this movie, I guess maybe just because it's kind of united around this theme of just how beautiful these geographies are, maybe that's just an easier theme to weave together across all the different plot lines. But I did find it to be a lot more unified in its message, and but also, you know, you're not, like, I think it would be a completely different movie if it was just about the mother and daughter hiking up mm-hmm. through those trails and
which I think
up to Alaska.
What I thought it was going to be. So
yeah.
I thought it was going to be like Cheryl Strayed's Wild. It was going to be sort of a mother-daughter adventure exploration, you know, discovering each other, discovering themselves through this 22-kilometer trek. 2,200 kilometer.
Yeah.
2,300 kilometer
oh,
trek through the Cascade Mountains from Squamish to Skagway, Alaska.
Yeah.
And then it branched off into these other things, and each one was as compelling as the last.
No, I know. Yeah. I'd say the nuns up in like wherever that was, close to Squamish.
Yeah, Garibaldi Highlands.
That was probably the most compelling element of it for me.
I had never heard of the Queen of Peace Monastery.
Yeah.
And so I actually looked it up and recommended it to my brother, who does silent retreats and is a former Catholic priest.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I don't think we get in the documentary is they're actually a contemplative order, which means they only speak for 1 hour a day.
Oh, wow.
So the talking heads that we do get to see, I guess Grant just had to plan.
Wait for that 1 hour.
This is your 60 minutes that you're going to talk, and you're going to talk to me, which is probably pretty special.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I like that it's, you know, it seems like it has a Christian element to it, but it's kind of non-denominational in a way, and mm-hmm. and they welcome anyone to just come and And it's almost as if the mountains are their religion in a way. Mm-hmm. And like that idea was just really resonant for me because I grew up skiing, and that's something that I really cherish, is just being at the top of a mountain on my own, you know, maybe with some Radiohead in my ears or something like that. And right. just the calm that comes over you, even if you're on a mountain with, you know, thousands of people around you, there's still just this idea of kind of you and nature, and you can shut everyone else out, especially if you have the Radiohead in your ears.
Right. Right.
And like just the again, talking about drone photography in the last segment,
oh.
I feel like here it's even better.
Wow.
With you know, just these wide open expanses of just cloudy snow, with this nun cross-country skiing
yes.
in her whatever you call that clothing, like
yeah, her habit.
Her habit, okay. That was like I like it kind of brought me to tears almost. Like
it was divine.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
No, it really
actually
was, yeah.
brings divinity.
Mm-hmm.
So even in a secular way, the beauty makes this vista divine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm. And then I'm just trying to remember all the different directions it goes in.
The opening shot is Simon Beck, who's a snow artist.
Mm, yeah, that was amazing.
When I think that's a drone shot that we pull away and see the art that Simon has created, which is the equivalent of running a marathon, he said. So
yeah.
he's just using skis to create art.
Yeah.
In virgin snow, and when the drone pulls back, it's this
massive
again. I almost
snowflake.
Cried.
Yeah.
It
no,
was
I
just
know.
Absolutely beautiful. It was, and so precise.
Yeah,
like it wasn't non-conceptual. It was this perfect thing.
Snowflake. Yeah.
Oh my God! It was just
yeah.
stunning.
Yeah, and you just like you don't really know what he's trying to accomplish when
yeah.
he starts, and he's
just a lot of trudging and crunching
yeah.
of snow,
and he's talking about these things and how it's really hard, but like and then all of a sudden it reveals his name and it says he's a snow artist, and you're like, okay, what does this mean? And then
right.
yeah, it pulls out, it's like, holy fuck,
amazing.
Yeah. And then I guess there's the other artist, something Thor.
Bernhardt.
Yeah. Bernhardt. Yeah.
Thor.
Who's up? I'm forgetting the area that it was, but anyway, he's
Invermere, maybe.
Yeah, but he's in a remote enough area that I guess they can't even leave their house in the winter because there's no roads or anything.
Yeah, 6 to 8 hours to get to the cabin.
Yeah,
off the grid.
And I guess from his early 20s, he and his wife just decided to go up and live up there, and he works on various forms of art. I found myself distracted during a lot of that segment because they kept showing the couple's names next mm. to them every time they came on screen, like 10 times in a row. And it's like, I got it. There's only two people.
Yeah.
I know what their names are.
It's a 7-minute segment.
Yeah.
We'll catch up.
it really threw me off. And I just kind of kept looking for their names. So that threw me off a bit. But, I guess, again, just kind of reinforcing this idea of, you know, mountains aren't just something pretty to look at. It's kind of this way of life, and it can dictate how you're even able to live your life, in the sense of, you know, they are just shut-ins during the wintertime and that kind of thing. And, or even, you know, he's wanting to protect this idea of seclusion and he does that by destroying the biking trails and throwing trees across them,
yeah.
so that because his idea is that as soon as bikes show up, then mountain bikes show up, or then like motorbikes show up, and then snowmobiles show up, and then all of a sudden it's a resort and whatever. And,
right.
So he's doing his best to prevent that from happening. But I find it really. Really interesting how they kind of fuse together so many different aspects of not just mountain life, but just kind of you know, humans' existence in the world, and it just, it's so broad but also so specific, and it's just really successful on a lot of those levels.
And another surprise to me was, you think that people that would live a mountain life are just the thrill seekers, the swinging dicks that, you know, are adrenaline junkies. Mm-hmm. And then this couldn't be more sort of contemplative, meditative, and peaceful. Mm-hmm. Each person's story is about almost like a yogic meditation, because mm-hmm. you are simply either alone with your thoughts or the feeling of insignificance in the face of this, you know, grand nature. But it's such a peaceful thing. Nobody is an adrenaline junkie. Mm-hmm. Everyone is humbled by this divine beauty. And it was, I found it just to be so, everyone was very peaceful. And it wasn't about thrills and, you know, getting some tasty gnar on your snowboard. It was just really
well, and even those types of characters that you would expect to come out of the one segment, you get a completely different side of their personalities, because they are the, you know, the thrill-seeking skiers, the backcountry skiers, but, you know, they're talking about an avalanche experience and how one of their friends almost died. And so you get this completely different range of emotions than, you know, the adrenaline junkie that you might expect.
Right.
And you know, so that it's almost like no matter what, how you come at or what you think about mountains, they're going to dictate the terms to you.
Right. Right.
There are all these other elements of the movie, but it does still focus mostly on the mother-daughter team making their trip up to Alaska, and
the first women to ever have done so.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that. But yeah, I mean that whole experience just really shows kind of the full range of emotions that you get from all the other segments all in one, in a way, because. And again, like, I feel like that's why the cross-cutting and the going back and forth to different segments, why that works so well, is because they are all really tightly packed together and edited really strongly together, so that, you know, when something's happening here, then you see this other thing, or, you know, when things are getting really intense in their trek, you know, you get to go and chill with the nuns for a bit.
Right.
Like there's just a lot of, there's a lot of motion in the editing, and it just creates a really a full tapestry or you know, quilt or whatever you want to call it of this experience. But just when they get to that peak near the end, and the mother says, like, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life, like that moment, even though you don't get to experience it the way she does, because obviously she's been hiking for, you know, five and a half months. At this point, and you know, they've gone through moments of you know, thinking that they're running out of food and they might need to give up, or obviously not, death is never a threat in that context. Obviously they could just fall off the side of a cliff. But I guess what I was curious about in those segments is, was Grant Baldwin along on the hike with them the whole time? Because a lot of the footage that's captured is not, like, you know, selfies on an iPhone camera. It's like you're still getting those drone shots, you're getting those lateral camera movements, you're getting professional level cinematography that you know, a mother and daughter wouldn't be able to do themselves while they're on the track.
Yeah.
So I don't know. What are your thoughts there?
I think I read that Grant started off with them at the beginning, mm-hmm. then did a drop in the middle. So wherever 1,000 kilometers was, then Grant dropped in and then joined them at the end.
Near the end.
So
yeah.
Everything else, he said, was just done by Martina and Tanya and their GoPros.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. And again,
so I guess maybe they like one of them would go ahead and they would set something up and then he would follow or whatever.
Because there are definitely some shots that are just, they're almost like a Lawrence of Arabia shot when you see nothing, then the shimmer.
I've never seen Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh, shame on you. And don't watch it on your phone. Please. Yeah. Watch it on the big screen. But there's a scene where you just see something in the distance and then it comes closer. So there's shots that are just, the scale is so enormous.
Yeah.
That's not a GoPro on Tanya's head.
No.
That must be when Grant, you know, came in to do that part of the trek or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we're, I don't think we've touched on all the different segments.
There was another gentleman named Barry Blanchard. He was the Métis mountain guy.
Oh, yeah.
And
he was the climber.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, just the photography there.
Oh, my. He's got an ice hammer, and he's just sort of looks like descending like a frozen waterfall, almost looks like. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
And very silent.
Yeah.
And very peaceful as well.
Yeah.
And he has this great quote. He says, "We get so removed from our bodies and everything it can provide. It's nice to be the wolf for a bit."
Mm-hmm.
So to have to just keep scanning for what's happening in nature, as opposed to just the way we usually just blindly walk through life or look at our phone.
Yeah.
The wolf actually has to take everything in, and mm-hmm. you can't be an effective mountain guide or mountain climber unless you are anticipating everything and continually just scanning, because it could be fatal. One error. So you're not coasting.
Yeah.
You're a part of everything on a molecular level in order to do this, job.
Yeah. And actually I'm thinking of the anecdote that he has about there were some climbers in Europe and they were the first to mount this peak. And he talks about how when he read that story as a kid, it kind of ignited this fire in him and this passion to want to become a climber himself, because he had never experienced that sort of
fraternity,
specifically amongst men, mm-hmm. of not just supporting but also kind of nurturing and caring.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the example that he gives is of one of the climbers kind of putting himself in an awkward position against a rock so that his other friend can have a surface to sleep against, which is this guy's back.
Right. So,
yeah. This is just a phenomenal movie, I think.
Yeah, it is such a knockout. And though we had a screener, can you imagine being immersed in this movie?
Yeah, I probably will go see it again.
I probably will go see it as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, an iPad simply can't do this scale justice. And it's so beautifully shot.
I actually did watch it on my iPad, too.
Yeah, it's not right. I mean, I think we need to just feel the chill of that snow by having
it. It was close to my face,
yeah.
though.
It was an immersive experience.
Yeah.
So I highly recommend that people don't wait until it comes to, you know, VOD or iTunes, but mm-hmm. please take the opportunity to go see it on the big screen and you will be completely knocked out.
Yeah. So I guess you've done a lot more research into the program than I have, but I figure maybe we could just give a few thoughts on some other stuff that we're excited to see but haven't had a chance to see yet.
Mm-hmm. 1 second. So you and I had talked a couple weeks ago. You were very excited about the Lars von Trier movie.
Yes.
So that's still on your radar and you're going to go to that?
I don't know. I guess I haven't had the experience of seeing a Lars von Trier movie that people don't like as much, and I feel like this is one of those ones that people don't like as much.
Oh.
I've seen kind of the big ones that have been more critically acclaimed. Although I guess Nymphomaniac wasn't like a resounding success in terms of the critical response, but I feel like it was better than like what's that one with Willem Dafoe and Charlotte Gainsbourg? and there's like a fox
Antichrist?
That talks. Yeah, Antichrist. I guess like that one sort of was panned or whatever. So I don't know what to expect. Although I guess you would never really know what to expect with
God, no.
with one of his movies. But yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that. And there was another one that I wasn't even aware. Oh yeah, there was a movie that played at the festival a couple of years ago called Phoenix. And it was about this...
From what country?
It was from Germany. And it's about this woman who survives the Holocaust and then ends up, like... I think it might just be a living arrangement at first, but then she ends up getting into a relationship with the guy. And it turns out that he's actually, like, one of the abusers at the concentration camp that she survived.
Mm-hmm.
But she, like, doesn't remember right away. But then she does remember because of... Oh, and it's something to do with how he got into an accident and got facial reconstructive surgery.
Oh.
And then, like, she does discover at some point based on, like, how he, like, uses, like, some weird body movement that was very specific to him or some phrase that he said to her all the time or whatever, and she figures it out. And it all revolves around this song that she ends up singing to him at the very, and that's like the very last moment of the movie is her singing this song. And like, it was a song that was again, somehow related to their experience in the concentration camp. And so it's like, she reveals that she knows now.
Oh.
And, it's a fantastic movie.
Sounds great.
Yeah. And so this guy has another one, but I'm blanking on the name. But that was another one, just in terms of like the non-Canadian stuff that I'm all of a sudden like very excited for. But yeah, otherwise I really haven't paid too close attention to the schedule. How about you? What else you got?
It's similar to last year where I'm focusing on Indigenous stories and women-centered stories.
Mm-hmm.
But like last year, I'll pick Indigenous stories from different countries for Indigenous people. So there's one called Aga, which is Inuit. It's a fictional film. But Inuit people living in Siberia.
Mm.
I've never seen that before. And then Dawnland is about residential schools in Oregon. So I've never seen... It's a documentary. I've never seen Americans address... the issues that we're trying to address through our Truth and Reconciliation movement in Canada.
Right.
So I'm very curious to see what it's like in the U.S.
Sure.
And it sounds like it wasn't radically different. It might have even been worse.
Yeah.
So I'll keep you posted on that. And...
I see on your schedule there you've got Thanksgiving gobble gobble.
That's right. I'm taking Thanksgiving off to
that's nice.
To host a family dinner, so I will not be seeing any movies on the 7th.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few documentaries, or a movie that takes place in Nunavut, which is always pretty interesting because it's very exotic to me. And then, which... sounds like a lot of, as William would say, Brussels sprouts and not a lot of Doritos, but I do have some Doritos in there. I'm going to see Studio 54, a documentary about Studio 54 and its excesses, which should be very fun.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing a new Michael Shannon movie called What They Had. Everything else is pretty serious.
Yeah.
But
what's the Michael Shannon one?
It's about Alzheimer's, so it's a real pick me up.
Yeah, it's like when you say you're getting your Doritos from Michael Shannon, like I can't really think of many performances
sprouts,
that he gives that are all that light.
And I try not to.
Aside from his reading of that sorority sister letter, have you heard that?
No.
Oh my God, it's fantastic!
Is it like a Funny or Die thing?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, so it was this. This like sorority person that like was pissed off that her other sisters weren't like living up to the standards of the sorority or whatever, and just gives this very vulgar, crass email that she sends out to everyone,
right.
And like uses phrases such as cunt, punt, etc. and so they get Michael Shannon to do his like, you know, his best Zod impersonation kind of as like speaking of this email. It's hilarious.
I will have to look that up.
Yeah, we can maybe watch it while we wait for William to show
up. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, and then I think you and I are going to try and see Sharkwater if
yes.
we can.
Sharkwater Extinction.
Sharkwater Extinction.
Yes.
Which I think will be very, very popular.
Yes.
But we're going to try and get that in the first week of the VIF.
Definitely, yeah. I think since seeing the original one, and I'd like to do an episode on that, the original movie as well at some point, but just kind of an all around tragic story to do with Rob Stewart there dying recently, and then the first movie was just really well done as well. So
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the new one as well, and maybe even interviewing some of the production team because they're going to be in town as well. So.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Keep your ears out for that one.
Great.
Mm-hmm. So I guess we can wrap it up there for now. And maybe we will see you in line at the festival, or if not, on the interwebs. Thank you for listening, and we will catch you next time.
Enjoy the VIF.